diplomats are the creme de la creme of the civil service. They are, to a man and woman, fiercely bright, ambitious, and above all, discreet. Very discreet. Discretion is the essence of diplomacy. Craig Murray was not discreet. It cost him his job as ambassador to Uzbekistan. He did not like what he saw there, and he said so, publicly, too publicly. He was investigated for a series of disciplinary offences. He had a nervous breakdown. In the end, he was sacked. Although the Foreign Office, Craig Murray says, you weren't sacked, you retired.
Yes, they were having great difficulty sacking me because I hadn't really done anything that wrong, but they didn't want me to work for them anymore. So in the end, we came to an agreement where I accepted early retirement.
We'll come to all of that in a moment, but let's just look at this business of being a diplomat. People who know you say you're a fairly unlikely character to have gone into the diplomatic service right at the beginning. I mean, you're a bit of a loose cannon. You liked to drink. You liked a bit of gossip. I think you describe yourself as having two main interests, one gossip and one single malt whiskey. Commendable, but not necessarily in a diplomat.
No, they do go together terribly.
They do.
I never had a vocation to be a diplomat when I was a student. I was trying very hard to get a job, actually in the whiskey industry. I was quite keen to go into whiskey marketing. But it was 1984 when I left university. There were three.
Not having gone to public school, by the way, because that's the other thing that tends to characterise diplomats.
That's true. Nor Oxbridge.
Oxbridge.
State school and Dundee University. Oh. But I came in the top three for the civil service exams in my year. But I hadn't wanted to be a civil servant at all, but there were 3.5 million unemployed. It was very difficult to get any kind of job. And what I managed to get was a job in the diplomatic service, so I went with it.
And you got into a spot of bother fairly early on in Sierra Leone. You were involved with that chap, Tim Spicer, Colonel Spicer, who was accused of shipping arms to Sierra Leone.
Spicer was a mercenary, of course, and he was involved in this deal with Sandline. I was a deputy head of the Equatorial African Department in the Foreign Office. Spicer came in to see us and said that he was thinking of sending weapons to President Kabba. We told him he wasn't allowed to send weapons to Sierra Leone because of an arms embargo. And to my astonishment, he at a later stage claimed that at that meeting I had personally given him the go-ahead from the Foreign Office to launch a mercenary operation in Sierra Leone.
The committee of MPs looked into it all, didn't they? Didn't they conclude that you'd been a bit naive?
Yeah, but I think they concluded that I'd been naive in not realising that Spicer might claim that I'd said something I hadn't said. I suppose that's possible, but I had a witness. I wasn't alone with him in the meeting, and the witness fully supported my story, which was true.
Anyway, you were promoted after that. You ended up as ambassador in Tashkent in Uzbekistan. Were you surprised to get that job?
I didn't go immediately from one to the other. I was deputy high commissioner in Ghana. There we did a very good job organising and, to a large extent, supervising the Ghanaian democratic elections. And the opposition won and took power peacefully. Now, that doesn't happen very often in Africa at all, and that was viewed as a major achievement and a big feather in my cap. And it was kind of subsequent to that that I was appointed as ambassador to Uzbekistan. That was before 9/11. So at that time, Uzbekistan was seen as a human rights and democracy problem, not as an ally in the war on terror. Things, of course, rather changed.
Very important country, of course, because it's more Central Asians live there than anywhere else, don't they? I mean, it's a crucially important country.
Yeah, it's got half the population of Central Asia, and Central Asia, of course, is swimming in oil and gas. Uzbekistan itself has the world's eighth largest proven reserves of natural gas. Its surrounding countries have got a lot more oil, and of course it's immediately north of Afghanistan, an hour's flight by military jet from Russia and China, and 15 minutes flight from Iran. The Americans had a military base there because of its strategic importance. It was being used for operations into Afghanistan. It was a strong supporter of the war on Iraq and viewed as a key ally in the war on terror. For all those reasons, Western diplomats, my French and German, Italian colleagues there all said, we don't mention human rights.
Really?
because Uzbekistan's a close ally of the United States, and we don't want to rock the boat, in effect.
And what about the Foreign Office? Because we all know that it's become a cliche now, he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. I mean, was that, referring to the president, the dictator, did the Foreign Office say anything like that to you before you went? Did they warn you to lay off him?
No, it was really done by omission. I had an awful lot of briefings about Uzbekistan's strategic importance, about the oil and gas industry, about their role as part of a coalition of the willing and the war on terror. I really had no briefing on the human rights situation in the country.
None at all.
I can't recall any. If I did, it was an insignificant proportion of the briefing I was given.
You could, of course, have found out before you went, I suppose. Instead of relying entirely on Foreign Office briefings, you could have done your own bit of freelance.
I could have done, but I was actually quite a good corporate man.
Hard to imagine that, given what's happened since.
It is difficult to imagine that, but I was, and I'd moved extremely quickly up the Foreign Office ladder. My career had been a model of upward progression. I wasn't by nature a boat rocker in that sense.
How soon after you got there did you discover the truth of the place?
Very quickly. I'd been there a fortnight when a couple of things happened. I went to a dissident trial. I'd heard a dissident trial was on and decided to go.
Which, so at least they had trials.
They did, but it was like a Nazi show trial, with the sort of prisoners abased and humiliated and being screamed and yelled at by the judge. And the conviction rate in trials, in all trials in Uzbekistan, is 99%. So they only have trials in a kind of formalistic sense. It was just an awful experience. And one thing which struck me very strongly, stays with me to this day, is one old man was giving evidence, and two of the accused were nephews of his. He had sworn a statement to say that these people had contact with Osama bin Laden and had travelled to Afghanistan to meet Osama bin Laden. He was giving evidence in this very weak, quavering voice. And suddenly, he kind of found some inner strength and straightened up. I was only 2 or 3 feet away from him. And he said, "It's not true. This isn't true. They tortured my children in front of me until I signed this. We are poor farmers from Andijan. What do we know about Osama bin Laden? We don't know anything about Osama bin Laden." And at that moment, it just struck me, sort of humanly, that was the truth. And people were sentenced to death at the end of this trial. You know, it was an experience which hit me very strongly, and which sent huge shockwaves around the community in Tashkent, because no ambassador had ever turned up at a dissident trial. It was something not done. But then, either the day before or the day after, very at the same time, these photos arrived on my desk of the person who'd been boiled to death in Jaslik prison. And that also had a very strong effect on me. I mean, I received the photos of his body in terrible condition. And then, I suppose the culmination of that was my astonishment that this was a regime which plainly had strong American backing, and my American opposite number was desperate to play down all these things. And the whole thing really was quite a shock to me in that first month, and I felt like I'd woken up in the middle of Graham Greene's A Quiet American or something. It really was very difficult for me to assimilate it, but it was immediately plain to me that something was happening I couldn't go along with.
And did you not get on the phone, or however you communicate with your bosses in the Foreign Office, and say, "Look, this is happening, I'm going to speak out, we can't tolerate this, why didn't you tell me about it before I came," and so on and so on?
I'm not sure about the last bit about why didn't you tell me about it, but I certainly went back. I mean, I reported all these things in detail back to the Foreign Office.
In the normal diplomatic way.
In the normal diplomatic way.
And all that sort of stuff, yes.
Exactly. And I proposed to make a speech on the subject, and blow the lid, if you like, which I did. I made a speech in October 2002, which caused, you know, quite a stir.
And the Foreign Office approved that speech?
They did approve the speech, but after some really pretty heated correspondence on both sides, I sent them...
After you delivered it?
No, I sent them a draft.
Right.
Subsequently, I was accused of railroading my speech through a too junior level in the Foreign Office.
But you did get it through one way or the other, and you delivered it in full.
Yes, I did. And there were it wasn't quite as strong as my first draft, because I did accept some amendments from London. But you delivered it.
And what happened? What was the immediate reaction to that?
The American embassy stopped talking to me. they were extremely annoyed, because I immediately followed a speech by the American ambassador in which he'd said that things weren't that bad and were getting better. And I said, no, they're awful. There's no sign of a movement towards democracy, and it's getting worse. And I got called in by the Uzbek foreign minister and kind of dressed down for saying such things. And London became more wary of me and more frosty towards me.
But they didn't formally reprimand you or anything of that nature. They didn't actually discipline you about it at that stage.
Not at that stage, no. They started getting very angry with me a month later. And what happened is I was reading intelligence material sent out by MI6, which was CIA material that MI6 were passing on. And the CIA themselves were getting it from the Uzbek security services. And it wasn't true, in effect. And it was talking of links between opposition groups in Uzbekistan and Osama bin Laden. And it was talking of training camps for Islamic terrorists in the hills above Samarkand. And we just knew from the situation on the ground that this wasn't a true picture. And I was wondering how they got this. And it occurred to me suddenly, wow, this material probably got under torture. So I went back to the Foreign Office saying, we're getting material from Uzbek security services. It's untrue. Yeah, it's painting a false picture. It's almost certainly obtained under torture, because I've not come across an example of a political detainee who wasn't tortured. And we should stop getting it. And at that stage, the whole tone of my relationship with the Foreign Office changed, and they started getting very, very angry with me.
The Foreign Office is absolutely clear, the British government is clear, that it does not sanction torture, it does not approve of torture, it doesn't ask any foreign government to carry out tortures on its behalf, and that if information it has offered to it has been obtained through torture, it makes allowance for that when it is evaluating that information.
The difficulty with that approach is that they obtain information regularly from governments that they know use torture to obtain information. Like in Uzbekistan, where it's not one or two pieces of material that you happen to come across. It's a regular system for getting Uzbek material that will have been obtained under torture. You don't have to specifically request it. In March 2003, I was summoned back to a meeting in Whitehall, and I was told that my telegrams had been discussed with C, the head of MI6, and Jack Straw personally, and that Jack Straw decided we should continue to get the Uzbek intelligence, and that really I was creating a hell of a problem and stink, and the decisions that we ought to be operating the way we were taken by ministers, and I was only an ambassador, and I should shut up, in effect.
Isn't that a defensible position from their point of view? The Foreign Secretary, the head of MI6, both knew what was going on in a way that you didn't. And perhaps there is something to the argument that says if information might, I emphasize might, help to prevent another atrocity such as 9/11, they would be remiss in failing to take note of it.
I've never met any other international law, and I've discussed this with a very great many by now, who agreed that torture material is legal. And it wasn't the kind of material that would prevent another 9/11. It really was dross.
That may well be true, but is it for you, as an ambassador who's paid to represent your country's interest, to question your superiors?
I think in terms of something like torture, which is completely prohibited by law in the way that slavery is prohibited by law, I think on that issue, yes, that is an issue on which any civil servant, you wouldn't have to be an ambassador, you know, if my most junior member of staff were questioning it, I'd feel they had every right to push it as hard as they could.
And the following August, you went on holiday, you went to Canada, you were called back early from your holiday and told what?
I was told that London had decided it would be best if I resigned as ambassador to Uzbekistan. I was told that in my absence on holiday there had been an investigation into my conduct in Uzbekistan, and that in consequence 18 charges of disciplinary wrongdoing had been brought against me, which included being an alcoholic, in effect, which included offering visas in return for sex, which included making money from official transactions, and various others, down to one of driving a Land Rover down some steps.
Well, let's start with that last one. You did drive a Land Rover down steps, which is hardly an ambassadorial sort of thing to do.
Yeah, well, it was on private property. It wasn't in the street. And they were, and it's more like a terrace than steps. They were
nonetheless
outdoor steps. No, we were on an embassy away day, which we'd actually taken the staff on as a kind of team bonding thing. And you don't behave in, you know, as you do in the office when you're on an embassy away day. It was perfectly safe. In fact, the defense attaché, who was a colonel in the Royal Military Police, had got out and done a check on the, you know, the clearance of the steps and the angle and all that sort of stuff to make sure it was a safe thing to do.
And what about the drinking? You do like a drink, by your own admission.
I do like a drink, but I've never been an alcoholic. I've never been drunk at work.
Never had a hangover when you've gone into the office in the morning?
I'm sure I've occasionally had a hangover when I've gone into the office in the morning. And in fact, of the 18 charges, two of them came down to an actual hearing. 16 were dropped, and the drink charge came down to an accusation that on a particular morning, I had said that I had a hangover and was going home to sleep it off and coming back in later, which was almost certainly true. I can't actually recall the specific occasion, but I've never gone off the round of golf, which is something I don't do, but which many ambassadors do in the middle of a working day. No one would have thought anything of it whatsoever. And of course, you don't work office hours, and you do actually have to drink a lot.
You have to go to cocktail parties. You don't necessarily have to drink alcohol.
No, if you're in the former Soviet Union, you do by and large. There are an awful lot of events at which you go to. I recall one Uzbek minister's birthday party, for example, where vodka toasts were being taken at great length. I think everyone had to propose a toast of about 18 people around the table. And if you don't drain your glass, you are viewed as unpleasant and unfriendly and not getting along with the country. I'm not trying to hide the fact I like a drink anyway. I do like a drink. I've never made any secret of it. But it's never had any deleterious effect on my work.
A serious charge was that you had been effectively selling visas for sex.
Yeah, it was an astonishing charge. And would be criminal, were it true. There's absolutely no foundation to it whatsoever. I had had an affair with someone. My marriage had split up. That had happened. I mean, that happens to rather a lot of people, including rather a lot of ambassadors.
You were invited to resign. You said you wouldn't do that. And in the end, you had a nervous breakdown.
Yeah, I was under huge pressure. I'd been given a deadline to resign by. I went back on the 22nd of August. I'd been given a deadline to resign by the 28th of August. Told that I mustn't tell anyone why. I mustn't mention the disciplinary allegations. I just had to resign and leave without any word of explanation. And the pressure of that became too much. It's hard to get over to you the shock. I view myself as a reasonably honest, decent person. To suddenly face having your reputation shredded, and when you really haven't sold visas for sex, I've never been corrupt or stolen money, to suddenly be faced unexpectedly with those kind of allegations really does a tremendous damage to your sense of self-belief. And then there was this feeling of being trapped, and I wasn't allowed to tell anyone about it. I wasn't allowed to prepare a defence. I wasn't allowed to do anything. I went into a deep, deep, deep depression. It's hard to describe to you how horrible that is. I mean, it really was this feeling of not wanting to carry on, not actually actively wanting to kill yourself, but not wanting to live.
After the charges against you were dropped, you went back to Tashkent.
Yeah, I went back in January of 2004, and was there for 6 months, basically. At the end of that period, a Foreign Office circular issued in the wake of Abu Ghraib and the events there, which said that we wished to make plain we were completely against torture, and if we suspected torture by British forces or by any of our allies, we should report it. I'd been keeping my head down for 6 months because I'd been deeply wounded by what had happened the year before. But I went back in response to that, saying that I couldn't really square what we were saying now with what I'd been told about torture intelligence the year before, and that the Uzbeks plainly were using torture all the time. And I was under standing instruction always to refer to the Uzbeks as our allies when I made a public speech. And I reiterated the points I'd made previously about torture and intelligence.
Did that seal your fate?
What happened was that telegram was leaked to the Financial Times, not by me. And it was the leak to the Financial Times, which was the reason I was removed as ambassador in Tashkent. I suspected, and still suspect, that it was a Foreign Office who actually leaked that to the Financial Times in order to give a pretext for removing me. So I was pretty annoyed at that, and also wanted to set the record straight in on the issue. So I decided at that stage to go public and go to the media. And that was what led to me being removed from the diplomatic service.
Because eventually, of course, you ended up on the Today programme.
I did. It was, in fact, the Today programme specifically, which was the reason given I was suspended from the diplomatic service.
So my interview with you caused your downfall.
I think that's true, if I don't hold it against you.
You paint a picture of a Foreign Office run by dreadful people, and the sort of people who would consider, or at least you were prepared to believe, consider fabricating evidence against a wholly innocent man, destroying his reputation, just to get him out of the country so that they could, in effect, protect the dictator of that country, a man who was ordering the most appalling tortures. And we were making use of the evidence that came, or non-evidence that came from those tortures. This is an absolutely disgusting way for the Foreign Office to behave, if it's true.
Yeah, I mean, I really find it hard to believe it happened. You know, I at the time I couldn't believe what was happening to me, which is why I cracked up. And now it's very, very difficult to think this really goes on, this really happens.
Why haven't we heard of it before? Why has no previous ambassador or Foreign Office employee experienced what you experienced? Do you believe you were the first one, or do you believe that others simply did what they were told, resigned like good boys, went quietly? I mean, why Craig Murray?
I find it hard to understand why I'm the only one who couldn't accept our obtaining intelligence through torture, because many people must have been in contact with the issue, and our ambassadors in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, would be seeing you know, exactly the same issues I'm seeing,
and over a very long period of time as well.
Yeah, over much longer than it's happening in Uzbekistan. And that, you know, there must be hundreds of people in MI6 and the Foreign Office who deal with this issue on an everyday basis. And
so is half the Foreign Office corrupt, or are ambassadors all immoral people, or amoral people who really don't care? Is Craig Murray again the only one who has this highly developed conscience?
That's a difficult thing. I don't think of myself as having an unusually highly developed conscience. Despite all the evidence that it's me that's the odd one out, I feel like I was normal and doing what any decent person would do. When I was sending telegrams, strongly worded telegrams back on the subject, I was copying them to many other posts, to all Islamic posts, all European Union posts, all NATO, using Foreign Office distribution codes. And I was getting scores of messages of support, literally scores, including many from ambassadors of a senior grade to me, So there are many people who are deeply unhappy with what was going on, but no one else was sending telegrams like I was, or really people agreed with me but were keeping quiet about it.
But just to go back to this, why you were selected by the Foreign Office for this appalling treatment, I mean, are you inviting us to believe that what happened to you was an aberration, or that the circumstances were so exceptional, or that this is the way the Foreign Office behaves? Because if it is the latter, then we should be deeply ashamed of what our Foreign Office is doing, and we should demand that heads roll. Because some people will listen to this and say, maybe it's Mr. Murray who's exaggerated it a bit, or maybe, you know, the fact that he had a nervous breakdown suggests that he's the sort of guy who just couldn't take the strain in the wrong job, and, you know. And obviously the Foreign Office is not reluctant to feed that version of events.
No, Foreign Office is telling everyone I'm a nutter. I've been for some time.
Put it more simply than I did.
It's how the Foreign Office behaved in my case. Why they came down quite so hard on me, I've never fully understood, and still don't fully understand, but they did. And I wonder, I have, for example, wondered whether I hit on a larger point than I realised. And it has been claimed in a lot of American media recently that the CIA was sending people to Uzbekistan under extraordinary rendition, specifically in order to be tortured. Now, it could be that what I, without knowing it, what I was saying was cutting across the whole basis of the extraordinary rendition program, which I didn't at that time know existed. But the other thing, I think, is the psychology of the war on terror. I think things changed after 9/11, and this idea that you were with us or against us, and that I was unpatriotic, I was almost a traitor, because I wasn't fully up for war on terror, I wasn't prepared to subscribe to the idea that anything goes in defeating Al-Qaeda, etc. So, I think I was regarded as a bit beyond the pale, and maybe that legitimised in their eyes what they were doing to me. But I genuinely still find it hard to believe myself that what happened, but it did.
Craig Murray, thank you very much.
Thank you.
On the Ropes was presented by John Humphreys and produced by Steve Peacock. Next week, the first major interview with the former lead